You ready?
Your mic's not on, though.
Good evening. My name is Bill Jones. I'm with the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or the NRC. The NRC is an independent federal agency with the mission to license and regulate the nation's civilian use of byproduct, source, and special nuclear materials to ensure adequate protection of public health and safety, and promote the common defense and security and prevent and protect the environment. Tonight, several members of the NRC staff are here with me to discuss a number of issues regarding the licensing, regulation, and inspection of nuclear facilities, including the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, and to provide a forum for members of the community to comment and ask questions regarding our role in the safety oversight of users of nuclear materials, including the operators of Diablo Canyon. Tonight's meeting is a town hall-style meeting designed to provide for discussion and comments between the NRC and the community. We are holding a town-style meeting here in San Luis Obispo, based in part on the feedback we have received from members of the public and local organizations. We have in attendance tonight a diverse group of individuals with the NRC to facilitate open and informed discussions as best we can in those areas important to the community. As in the past, we will be using a moderator to facilitate the discussions. One area that we will provide additional background on is the spent fuel storage facility to be constructed at the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. To provide a common understanding of the independent fuel storage facility, the NRC has requested that Pacific Gas and Electric provide a brief overview of the independent fuel storage facility. The NRC will then provide a brief discussion of our inspection activities related to the independent fuel storage facility. These presentations will be short to ensure that the vast majority of time is spent in direct discussions with the individuals in the audience. This meeting will conclude at 9 p.m. tonight. A short break will be provided about the halfway point. The NRC staff will be available following this meeting. You have noted that tonight's meeting is being videotaped by AGP Video and will be shown on the local channels as has been done for previous meetings. In addition, the NRC has provided feedback forms at the entrance to this meeting room. The NRC highly values your input, and we request that you complete the feedback forms and send them in. No postage is necessary, or provide them to an NRC staff member before you leave. You'll also find additional background information, including a copy of the slides that will be used tonight on the back table. A meeting summary will be provided in 10 days, including within that summary will be the attendance list that is available at the entrance to this room. At this time, I would like to introduce the NRC staff members at the front table and those who are located in the audience. At the front table tonight is Mr. Art Howe, Director, Division of Reactor Projects in Region 4, Dr. Blair Spitzberg, the Chief Fuel Cycle Decommissioning Branch out of Region 4, Ms. Patricia Milligan, a Senior Level Advisor in the Division of Preparedness and Response in the Office of Nuclear Security and Incident Response, and Mr. Randy Hall, the Project Manager in the Office of Nuclear Material Safety and Safeguards in the Spent Fuel Licensing Section. In the audience tonight with the NRC, we have Mr. Alan Wang, the Project Manager in the Office of Nuclear Reactor Regulation, Mr. Vincent Everett, Senior Health Physicist, Fuel Cycle Decommissioning Branch in Region 4, Mr. Ray Keller, an Inspector, Health Physicist, Fuel Cycle Decommissioning Branch in Region 4, Mr. Victor Drix, our Public Affairs Officer, Mr. Ron Capriva, my Senior Project Engineer for Project Branch B, who will be moderating tonight's meeting, Mr. Tim McConnell, the Resident Inspector at Diablo Canyon. Mr. McConnell, along with Mr. Terry Jackson, are the two NRC inspectors who are located at the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. They perform the day-to-day inspections out there and have responsibility for implementing the baseline inspection program at Diablo Canyon. They also have responsibility for responding to any events or conditions that may occur out at the facility in a real-time manner, and these individuals are members of your community. In addition, I'd like to introduce Ms. Agnes Chan, Ms. Chan is also a member of the local community, and she is the resident inspector administrative assistant. Also assisting us at the Diablo Canyon plant is Ms. Stacy Sakai, and she is on rotation from the Office of Nuclear Reactor Regulation for 4 months. Art, at this time, I'd like to provide you an opportunity to make some comments.
Thanks, Bill. Again, my name's Art Howell, and I just wanted to take a moment to thank all you folks for coming tonight. I know this is a busy time of year, and we really do appreciate you all coming out. We have a good turnout. We did bring a number of NRC staff members with us tonight to answer a mix of questions, and we want to do that. If we do get questions that we can't answer, please get with us after the meeting. I'll give you my contact information. Any of the staff members here will call us, send us an email. We will get you an answer to your question if we can't answer it tonight. So thank you. Look forward to the meeting.
Thank you, Art. At this time, I would like to introduce the moderator, Ms. Ron Capriva. Mr. Capriva will provide a discussion of the guidelines for conducting this meeting tonight. We will then proceed directly with the background on the independent spent fuel storage facility and on to the questions and comments from the audience. Mr. Capriva.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Excuse me. I'd like to welcome you to the town hall meeting this evening. As facilitator, my responsibility is to assist in making sure that the information presented from the NRC is clear and responsive, and also would ensure that everybody who would like an opportunity to speak tonight has that opportunity. I'd like to take a few minutes for the format of the question and answer session and some ground rules that we would like to present. As far as the format, we're going to try to make it simple to maximize the interaction with you. The expectation is that the questions and answer period be conducted in a professional, orderly manner. With respect to the ground rules and questions, what I would prefer to do is to have you signal me, come to the aisle that I can get to you, and then present your question or your comments for the people at the front table or the PG&E people present. We'd like to keep the questions and comments succinct and concise and try to limit to 3 or 4 minutes. If possible, and that would provide everybody here in the audience that has a question or concern a chance to speak. Again, our meeting tonight is going to be about 3 hours long, and about halfway through that, we would like to take a short break. Also ask that when we are in the audience, and I am coming around to each of you for your questions and answers, and that only one person speak. That would give that person their attention, and also eliminate any kind of distracting side conversations. Again, if we don't get to everybody's questions tonight, you can either feel free to contact us tonight after the meeting, or you can contact our public affairs officer. Again, that's Mr. Victor Drix, and his phone number is 1-800-952-9677. With that said, I'd like to start the presentation. I'd like to introduce Mr. Gerald Strickland. Mr. Strickland is the project manager for PG&E for the dry cask, or excuse me, the dry fuel storage.
Is that better? That is. Good. Good evening. What I'd like to do tonight is take a little time and give you a quick overview of what the used fuel project is comprised of. So what I'll be covering is some background on the decision on moving forth with dry storage. I'll also go through and talk about the process of permitting and licensing a dry storage facility. From there, I'll step in and talk in brief terms of what the whole tech storage system is that PG&E will be employing at Diablo Canyon. With that, then, I'll also talk about how the whole tech system will be handled within the power plant and then within the power plant properties as it goes up to the storage facility. From there, then, I'll move forth and talk more about the actual storage facility, how it'll be constructed, the format of the facility, and so forth, and then the modifications to the power plant itself that will be necessary to be able to implement dry storage. And, of course, with that, then I'll close with some discussions on what the schedule looks like for being able to put this facility into operation. So how did PG&E make the decision to go ahead and move into dry storage? It became very clear in the mid-90s that Yucca Mountain would not be fully operational in 1998. And so as such, PG&E started investigating various options for providing additional interim storage at Diablo Canyon. In 1999, the decision was made to go ahead and proceed with a dry storage facility in lieu of re-racking the wet storage system with higher density racks. From there, then in the year 2000, we entered contractual terms with Holtec International, one of the leading companies in the world at this point for both dry and wet storage systems. And Holtec will in turn then be providing a dry storage system for Diablo's use. From there, then we entered a long process that has taken approximately 5 years now to do the licensing and permitting required to be able to develop a dry storage facility. So, permitting and licensing. I look at that process as being a very complex puzzle. And so one of the major pieces of that puzzle is the obtaining of a Part 72 license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to be able to develop, operate, and eventually decommission a dry storage facility. We applied for that license, went through the various regulatory process of reviews, the litigation that we were involved with, and received approval last year from the NRC to go ahead and proceed with the development of the facility. As part of that, in order to implement dry storage, we're required to enter into what's called a Part 50 license amendment. The Part 50 license is the license that governs the actual operation of Diablo Canyon. So in order to be able to use dry storage, there are a number of modifications that we've had to implement with the Diablo facility that we then had to receive permission from the NRC to be able to amend our license and make those modifications. With those actions behind us, we then had to move into the state process. The key part of the state process was the obtaining of a coastal development permit. That process was a process that took, again, almost 5 years. We worked with the County of San Luis Obispo and ultimately with the California Coastal Commission to obtain the permit to be able to proceed with developing the facility. That permit was acquired in February of this year and then opened the door for us to be able to proceed with obtaining the construction and grading permits to the County of San Luis Obispo. So what is the Holtec storage system? The key part of the Holtec system is the item that's shown on top, which is a multi-purpose canister. This canister is considered multi-purpose because it has the ability to be able to be used in a storage facility for interim storage, but yet at the same time has the ability of being able to be transported to a federal repository such as Yucca Mountain. You see a pair of paths here. The path on the right-hand side is the path that you'd use for being able to transport, and so that's the product line that they have that's called the High Star system. The system that we're using at this point is the product line on the right-hand side, which first has the multi-purpose canister that then is placed in a high-track transfer cask. That transfer cask is used for handling, providing shielding and so forth on a multi-purpose canister with fuel in it while it's in the power plant itself. The ultimate interim storage at the storage facility will be performed in the high storm overpack that you see on the bottom. I'll give you a little bit more information on that as I use the little pictures on the next few slides. What I wanted to do was use photos. Photos are worth a thousand words. And what I've done is I've taken a series of photos from the Fitzpatrick plant in upstate New York. And it provides a good overview of what this Holtec system really looks like. So what you see in this photo is on the forefront is the high-track transfer cask. And then on the right-hand side in the background, you see three multi-purpose canisters. As you can tell, they are very large commodities. The multi-purpose canisters in the background are approximately 5 feet in diameter and 15 feet tall. They're constructed out of stainless steel with the outer vessel being 3/4 inch thick. The transfer cask in the foreground, when loaded with the multi-purpose canister and fuel, weighs approximately 250,000 pounds. So it's a very large commodity. The transfer cask with multi-purpose canister in it is placed in our spent fuel pool, and in that pool, the fuel is then removed from the wet rack system and placed into a basket configuration within that multi-purpose canister. Our multi-purpose canisters are configured such that they will hold 32 fuel assemblies. Once the fuel is loaded into the multi-purpose canister, then we have a 9-inch thick stainless steel lid that's placed in the upper portions of that multi-purpose canister. From there, then a second retainer lid for the high-track transfer cask is placed on top and bolted in place to be able to protect the contents of that multi-purpose canister while we're then moving it out of the spent fuel pool. The transfer cask is then raised out of the pool. You see a number of individuals around the side of the pool. Those are part of our rad protection organization that in turn would be performing a deconning. They'd be essentially washing down, cleaning the surface of the transfer cask before they then move it out of the proximity of the pool and over into a storage stand for being able to then facilitate the next steps with the storage system. So what happens when it's in the stand is that we then remove the temporary lid off the top of the transfer cask. There's a automated welding equipment that's set on top of the multi-purpose canister that you see there. And then we use a couple of ports in that lid to be able to draw down the water to about one-third the height of that multi-purpose canister. With the water drawn down, then we can facilitate welding that 9-inch thick lid into the 3/4-inch thick shell of that multi-purpose canister. And that way then provides a good pressure vessel. Once that welding is completed, we then use the two ports on the top of that lid to then evacuate the rest of the water, go through a process of helium drying such that we then remove any other moisture out of the system, and then backfill that canister with helium. So from there, once those ports are closed off, we put another retainer lid on top and weld that in place for additional redundancy. So from there, then the lid is put, the high track lid is bolted back in place, and we then place that transfer cask on a low profile dolly and roll it out of the fuel handling building into the backyard. And as you'll see next to this photo, there is a large transporter. Diablo will have one that's very similar to this. That transporter is then used to be able to capture or pick up that transfer cask for then carrying it up to our cask transfer facility at the storage facility itself. Once it's at the storage facility, we'll do a transfer process whereby we'll do a stack up. There's actually a model in the background that you may have had an opportunity to look at. But what happens is that large storage overpack then has a mating device put on top of it, and the transfer cask with multi-purpose canister is bolted to the top of that. There's a door in the mating device that opens and removes the bottom lid of the transfer cask, and that multi-purpose canister can then be lowered down into the storage overpack. So from there, then the transfer cask is unbolted, it's moved to the side, and we use a transporter to be able to move it over to the ISVC. But before that, what I want to do is tell you the size of the storage overpack itself. It's approximately 11 feet in diameter. It's 19 feet high. It's built out of two steel vessels that are each 1-inch thick, and then the space between the steel vessels is filled with concrete. So a very strong, robust structure that actually weighs in excess of 340,000 pounds. So it's quite a large commodity. So in order to carry something like this, then again, we'll use the large transporter. That transporter captures that storage overpack and then moves it to our storage facility. Okay. So speaking of the storage facility, the development of this facility was put together in terms such that it would be sized to be able to accommodate all the fuel generated by Diablo during the 40-year license life. That way, at the end of the license life, if license extension is not sought by PG&E, then we'd have the ability at a point in time to proceed with decommissioning of the plant. The facility will have the ability to store up to 138 storage units, and we'll have security measures that are comparable to the power plant itself. In order to construct the facility, we'll have to do a large excavation project removing approximately 100,000 yards of rock material. The foundation system is very robust for the system. We're the only facility that has elected to anchor the storage system to the foundation because of the higher seismic zone that we're in. And so as such, the foundation system actually ends up being approximately 8 feet in thickness. The cast transfer facility is also unique for Diablo. Instead of having a large tower to facilitate the transfer from the multipurpose canister from the transfer cast to the storage overpack, we've elected to do a below-ground facility to be able to keep all the operation as close to ground level as possible. There are a number of other improvements along the site that we'll have to do as far as rerouting roads, rerouting utilities, and so forth to be able to accommodate the facility. I always like this photo. It's a good overview of what the Diablo site looks like and shows you that the storage facility, as is shown over on the left-hand side of the photo, is to the east of the power plant itself. I think click on it one more time. As part of the process, it's kind of hard to read the lettering there, but we'll be rerouting the road that's on the southern side of those reservoirs there to the northern side of the reservoirs. Included with that is rerouting an extensive amount of utilities. That's the work that's undergoing at this point in time. Click it again. And then from there you can see where the storage facility and the cast transfer facility will be located. The this drawing shows a good representation of what the storage facility will look like and the rerouting of the roads. The key point that I wanted to note with this is that it shows that the facility will be comprised of seven different foundations, seven different pads, each capable of holding 20 casks. And even though the facility has been sized for the seven foundations, which 138 total casks, and licensed and permitted for that number, PG&E's decision has been to construct the facility in phases, to where we will do all the excavation, we'll put all the security measures in place and all the infrastructure, but we will only construct the first two out of seven foundations, starting with the ones that are the furthest to the right side. And with that, that's a prudent action on PG&E's part in order to limit the amount of fuel that we store. We still have the hopes that in the near future that Yucca Mountain will receive its approval and that in turn that we'll be able to proceed with the DOE taking responsibility for the fuel and moving it to the federal repository. So what other changes are we doing? In order to implement dry storage at Diablo, we're having to make a number of changes inside the power plant. One of the big ones is that the fuel handling building crane is in the process of having a planned upgrade to single failure-proof capabilities. What that means is that it adds a lot of additional redundancy for being able to handle heavy loads such as this 250,000-pound transfer cask and multipurpose canister. So it's an important change that we're implementing. In addition, in the cask washdown area, I saw in one of the previous pictures from Fitzpatrick with the automatic welding equipment, what we have is a special restraint structure that has a work platform that we'll be utilizing to support that transfer cask for seismic considerations within the power plant while we do the removal of water and the welding of the lid in place. Being performed now, and actual construction implementation expected to take place in the third and fourth quarter of next year and the first quarter of 2007. From there, the job's not done. There's still a lot of programmatic changes that had to be implemented at Diablo as part of the startup. We expect that that process will be started in the third and fourth quarters of next year, and that will also proceed into the first two quarters of 2007. All that startup activity will then culminate in what the NRC calls a dry run testing. PG&E will be required to go through and do a mock-type scenario of being able to show that they can appropriately handle the dry storage system within the confines of the regulation. That will involve using dummy assemblies, dummy multipurpose canisters, and we'll have to be able to show that we can do the appropriate welding process and so forth to be able to get final approval for the NRC before we actually implement dry storage. That will take place in the August 2007 time frame. So from there, that should culminate with our first loading campaign of eight storage casks in November of 2007. And with that, that's all of my presentation.
I'd like to now introduce Dr. Blair Spitzberg. Dr. Spitzberg is the chief of the fuel cycle decommissioning branch of the NRC in the Region 4 office in Arlington, Texas.
Good evening. Can everybody hear me? Again, I'm Blair Spitzberg, and I'm the responsible manager for the inspection program for the independent spent fuel storage facilities in Region 4. My branch is also involved in the development of inspection guidance for the proposed high-level waste repository at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. So my staff and I are involved with ensuring the safety of spent nuclear fuel, whether it's in storage, in transport, and eventually when it will be disposed of permanently. I know that there's a lot of public interest in the safety of spent fuel, as there should be, so I'm happy that you came tonight to discuss this important topic with us. I know there's a lot of competing priorities for your time, especially this time of year, but your participation tonight reinforces the importance we know you place on these topics, and I believe it helps us to do our job more effectively. What I would like to discuss with you briefly tonight are topics I hope will address some of the concerns we hear voiced related to spent fuel dry storage facilities, like the one to be operated by PG&E at Diablo Canyon site. Let me start by pointing out that there's a term we use to describe this class of facility. That term is ISFSI, which is an acronym for Independent Spent Fuel Storage Installation. And I acknowledge that this term is rather long-winded and technical-sounding, and frankly, I wish we had a better name for it. However, it is the accepted name for these facilities, and it's used commonly throughout the regulatory, technical, and legal worlds. So let me try and simplify the term for you by defining what it is in simple, plain English. An ISFSI is a facility usually located at a nuclear power plant reactor site that utilizes an NRC-approved container system for storing highly radioactive spent nuclear fuel in a dry condition and without the need for forced cooling, such that it will remain safe and secure. It will not pose a risk to the health and safety of the public or the environment. My presentation will focus on how the NRC fulfills its mission to ensure such facilities are constructed and operated in a safe manner. I will keep my presentation brief in order to allow more time for your specific questions, but I do want to provide a short overview of our process in order to focus the discussion. I'm also aware that there are specific concerns in this area related to the Diablo Canyon spent fuel storage facility and its vulnerability to earthquakes and issues related to emergency preparedness and security. As I go through my presentation, I plan to touch on these topics, but if I don't go into enough detail, please make a note to yourself so that you can ask a specific question during the Q&A portion of the meeting. In the back of the room, where you entered, there's some tables set back there with some information that we've placed out there, some informative brochures and copies of my slides. I hope you'll take the advantage of taking these documents home with you to read and share with your friends and family, because they contain more detailed information on the topics we'll be discussing tonight, and they also contain specific directions. These comes from the Atomic Energy Act. The Act specifies those materials and facilities, such as the dry spent fuel storage facilities, that fall under the NRC jurisdiction. In 1980, the NRC added Part 72 to its regulations to specifically address the emerging need for additional interim storage of spent nuclear fuel. This need arose because nuclear power plant licensees could not reprocess their spent fuel nor ship it for permanent disposal. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982 directed the Department of Energy to develop a permanent repository for spent fuel, and to work with nuclear utilities to develop technologies for safe interim storage of spent nuclear fuel in a dry mode. In the Waste Confidence Decision, first issued by the NRC in 1989, the Commission found reasonable assurance that, if necessary, spent fuel generated in any reactor can be stored safely and without significant environmental impact for at least 30 years beyond the licensed site life of the operation of that reactor in either its spent fuel pool or at either on-site or off-site independent fuel storage installations. Further, the Commission concluded that there is reasonable assurance that at least one mined geologic repository will be available in the first quarter of the 21st century, and sufficient repository capacity will be available within 30 years beyond the licensed life for operation of any reactor to dispose of the commercial high-level waste and spent nuclear fuel generated up to that time. The Spent Fuel Project Office was created within the NRC in 1994 to manage the licensing of spent fuel storage facilities. SFPO performed the safety review for the Diablo Canyon Storage Facility license with the assistance of experts from the Center for Nuclear Waste Regulatory Analysis in San Antonio, Texas. SFPO also developed the inspection program for these facilities and provides guidance and resources to the regional offices who implement the inspection program. Randy Hall, who's to my left, is here to answer your questions, is the SFPO project manager for the Diablo Canyon storage license. This slide depicts the process for licensing a site-specific dry spent fuel storage facility. The process began with PG&E's license application filed in December 2001. A hearing was requested by petitioners and held with the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board. The licensing process went through a complete hearing process, including affirmation of the licensing board's decisions following appeal to the commission. And I know that some groups and citizens were not satisfied with the outcome of the hearings because some of the issues raised by the petitioners were not admitted into the hearing process. As a result, some of the issues not admitted have been the subject of a suit filed against the NRC, which is currently in the courts. In October 2003, the NRC issued the final environmental assessment for the storage facility. Outside consultations were conducted with the California Energy Commission, the California Office of Historic Preservation, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Formal comments received from the California Energy Commission are addressed in the environmental assessment. In February 2004, the NRC approved changes to the Diablo Canyon Site Security Plan to incorporate the spent fuel storage facility. Additional security orders for the storage facility were imposed in May of 2005 and will be implemented prior to initial fuel loading. And then in March 2004, the NRC issued the Diablo Canyon Spent Fuel Storage Facility license for a 20-year term. Included in the PG&E license application was a detailed safety analysis report addressing all aspects of the spent fuel storage facility. This slide depicts the major areas of technical review conducted by the NRC in accordance with our standard review plans. In simple language, the way NRC conducts the technical license review is to have technical experts in each of the areas listed perform a detailed, documented review to determine whether there is reasonable assurance that the design, construction, and operation of the facility will meet established safety criteria. These safety criteria consider the conditions under which the facility will operate, and in addition considers what can go wrong and how the facility will respond to what can go wrong. The licensing review includes examining the structural design and what we refer to as structures, systems, and components that are important to safety. These structures, systems, and components are relied upon to be available to work as designed and to protect the health and safety of the public. So we place considerable emphasis both in licensing and inspection of the facility on the structure, systems, and components that are important to safety. For a dry storage facility such as PG&E's, the list of structures, systems, and components that are important to safety is a relatively short list and includes such things as the canister. The NRC's inspection program is designed to independently verify safety and compliance of the spent fuel storage facility. It is also capable of taking necessary enforcement actions where noncompliance exists. There are three distinct phases of the NRC's inspection program: the construction phase, the pre-operational phase, and the operations phase. The NRC utilizes region-based, headquarters-based, and resident inspectors to complete our inspections. The three regional inspectors have over 25 years of related experience in the spent fuel storage area. The NRC headquarters inspectors assist during the pre-operational inspections and are also responsible for inspections that are performed at the dry storage fabricator facilities. The on-site resident inspectors assist by performing day-to-day oversight of the licensee's activities. This week, we have initiated the construction phase inspections and have two of our inspectors with us this evening. I think they were introduced earlier, but let me reintroduce them. They're standing in the back of the room, Mr. Vince Everett and Mr. Ray Keller. Mr. Everett and Mr. Keller are very experienced in this area of spent fuel storage and have completed an extensive training and qualification program to be certified as spent dry storage inspectors. And I would like to invite all of you to introduce yourself to Mr. Everett and Mr. Keller and speak with them either at the break or after the meeting. With the exception of the inspection reports that discuss sensitive information, the inspection reports for spent fuel storage facilities are generally publicly available through our website. If you wish to find these reports when completed or other relevant documents for the Diablo Canyon facility, you should go to the website address and search for docket number 72-026. I've mentioned that three phases of our inspection program for spent fuel storage facilities. The areas we inspect and the procedures we use are depicted on this slide. These inspection procedures are also available on our website. The construction inspection begins with the initial pad construction activities, including the soil excavation, the pad rebar construction, and concrete batching, transport, and placement. Since the Diablo Canyon pad is in a seismic zone, special requirements apply, including the anchorage of the cask. The inspectors will verify that the design requirements are included in Diablo Canyon procurement, fabrication, and construction procedures. The inspectors will also review the Diablo Canyon quality assurance oversight of construction activities as well as other fabrication activities. NRC inspection procedure 60854 is used for pre-operational dry run inspection activities at Diablo Canyon. As part of these inspections, the inspectors will witness the dry run demonstrations conducted by Diablo Canyon, including the movement of heavy loads, the radiation protection activities and programs associated with the dry fuel storage, the physical security requirements, changes to the emergency preparedness program associated with the spent fuel facility, changes to the fire protection program, the fuel selection procedure and loading requirements, the canister welding and non-destructive examination process. NRC inspection procedure 60855 is used for the ongoing operational inspection activities at spent fuel storage facilities. The operational inspections will include changes that were made to the Diablo Canyon programs, safety reviews performed, the effectiveness of radiological controls based on the actual loading operations, the effectiveness of the Diablo Canyon Quality Assurance Organization in providing oversight of the storage facility and affected programs, and the Diablo Canyon procedures compliance. So with this, this concludes my presentation. Again, let me thank you for coming here tonight, and I look forward to answering any of your questions. And so let me turn it back over to you, Mr. Capriva, to continue with the agenda.
Thank you. At this time, we'd like to start with our question and answer period. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would please remain in your seats until called upon. Raise your hands. I will come to you with a microphone, okay? Excuse me. Yes, ma'am. When you speak, would you please state your name, if you're affiliated with any group, what group that is, and then proceed with your question and comments. Again, we would all appreciate it if you tried to keep them concise and a couple minutes long, and that would give everybody here a chance to speak. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Henrietta Groot, and my question concerns communications during emergencies, during disasters. I am a member of the San Luis Obispo County Emergency Communications Council. That means I'm a ham, a radio amateur, in that we have not been included. Are we supposed to come out of the woodwork when we're needed? We need to work on our, what we would do. We need to be included in the practices. So my question is, what does the NRC do about requiring counties to have that part of the plan in place? Do you require that counties indeed include volunteer hams in the practices? The county has county personnel have stated that they don't have the money to include us, but that's kind of silly because the hams are all volunteers, so I don't know what the money is needed for. Now, Katrina clearly demonstrated that communications are very important, and actually I understand that fire and police personnel in Louisiana still cannot talk to each other on radios. So please tell us what you can do to encourage that part of the emergency planning. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Patricia Milligan, and I'm got a real squeak here. It's better? Okay. Sorry about that. I'm with Emergency Preparedness Group back in our NRC headquarters office. The NRC doesn't require the inclusion of ham operators in the emergency plan for off-site officials or off-site organizations. Each FEMA, part of Department of Homeland Security, has general plans and guidelines that off-site communities are expected to meet. It's very difficult for us in Washington to prescribe specific plans for each community. We leave that up to local officials, because local officials know and understand their communities, what works, who's available, what kind of resources are available. I know after the World Trade Center disasters, the terrorist attacks on September 11th, it was recognized that there were some problems with communication and frequencies amongst local law enforcement and responders. And I know Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Communications Commission have been working closely towards resolution in that regard. I don't know specifically what's going on in your community. I know there are some folks here from your community in that position of authority who may be able to talk to you and a little bit more. We can talk certainly offline a little bit more about some of your concerns, and perhaps we can get with FEMA to see how it's included in the planning. I don't know your plans intimately enough to be able to comment directly on that.
My name is Jeff Grantin. I work for the County of San Luis Obispo as a Supervisor of Emergency Services, also the Deputy County Administrator. I know that we do include amateur radio people in all of our emergency planning, so I'm not quite sure what you mean by we're not including you, and I'd love to talk to you at the break about that to find out exactly what your concerns are and to get you included more.
Exercise.
Yes, they are. We do have our RACES people in our exercises every time we exercise. So we will meet, and we will talk at the break. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Jane Swanson, spokesperson for San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I also live within 11 miles of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Plant. In early of December 2005, the Mothers for Peace received a phone call from a person who reported a disturbing incident in a plane over Diablo Canyon. The identity of this person is not known to Mothers for Peace, but this person did give us details of this incident in writing and has requested that we make his report publicly. I will read a section of this written report, just a short section. So, quote, in the middle of May 2005, a friend and I were flying off the coast some 2 or 3 miles from the plant. On a dare, we decided to test the air security of the plant, not knowing what to expect. From an altitude of 1,500 feet, we began a high-speed aggressive dive at a 45-degree angle directly toward the power plant. At an altitude of only 500 feet, we dive-bombed directly over the top of the containment domes. We could have crashed our plane within seconds and within a few feet of any location at the plant. We got their attention as I could see people running around below us. I thought for sure we were being shot at and that a chase plane or helicopter would come after us. We flew to an airport, tied down our airplane. I know there's a no-fly zone over Disneyland, and I would like to think that there would be one over all nuclear power plants. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. For those of you, I know that there's many folks in the audience that were here during the meeting back in June, and there were a number of similar questions about the measures that the NRC has taken in response to the terrorist acts of 9/11. And just briefly, an overview, there's essentially three elements to the increased security measures that have been taken. And the first involves, obviously, prevention of any sabotage event, any event involving theft or diversion. And in general terms, a number of activities have been taken in that regard. And in fact, we have some information brochures in the back table here entitled Protecting the Nation, and it goes into some detail about the measures that have been taken. And those include such things as enhanced threat assessment capabilities. We work very closely with other federal agencies, intelligence agencies. We work very closely with the FAA, as well as the plants. And in regard to aircraft issues, there is a very sophisticated reporting system that's in place. I'm not aware of the particular incident that you just mentioned. I don't know if Diablo Canyon is or not. But in general, we would not discuss those details because of their sensitivity involving potential security threats. But in addition to the actions we have taken to coordinate more closely with threat assessments, there are other actions that we have taken in terms of coordinating with the military, in terms of diversion of aircraft, detection, more timely detection of aircraft. And so all those measures are in place. And so that's just one element, and I could go into much more detail about prevention, but obviously the whole idea is to prevent the event from occurring. Now, having said that, you know, terrorist threats are highly unpredictable, and we have to prepare, all of us in this business, those who regulate and those who operate the facilities, for these events. And so a number of mitigative strategies have been put in place. And if you look at back in the brochure again, it will talk about a number of vulnerability assessments that were done that encompasses a range of aircraft threats in which the NRC did a number of studies using state-of-the-art structural analysis and fire hazards analysis, working with the national laboratories to look at a representative number of plants to see what more could be done to further enhance the protection of these facilities. And I think some of you are aware that the National Academy of Sciences also did their own study on spent fuel pool storage and made a number of recommendations. And as a result of that, we're in pretty close agreement with the National Academy of Sciences. And one of the recommendations was that given the design differences between the plants, there would be benefit in looking at each plant specifically to see what other mitigative strategies could be identified and implemented to increase the level of protection even further. And those reviews are in progress right now, and they include a broad range of damage footprints that would encompass many types of aircraft, including those representative of the 9/11 attack, as well as waterborne attacks and land attacks. So that effort is in progress. I did mention that at the last meeting, and it's ongoing. And then finally, the third leg, if you will, is given this event, if an event occurs, is emergency preparedness. And the key is on planning and taking steps to make sure that in the unlikely event that there is a accident, that emergency preparedness elements are in place so that health and safety of the public is assured. And there's been a number of ongoing activities in that area as well. And we'd be happy to share further details with you after the meeting. Thank you.
Did you finish your second question?
If it's possible, to reiterate my second question, is there a no-fly zone over Diablo Canyon?
No, there isn't. There is a number of things the FAA has done that pertain to commercial aviation in terms of flight paths and whatnot, and then there's also for general aviation instructions or notice to airmen about not loitering around nuclear power plants, and so that is out there. And as I said, there is a reporting system that's in place, and I can assure you on many occasions, and I have a stack this thick in which reports have been made and follow-up has been done and with the FBI and other federal agencies to understand the nature of the concern throughout the nation.
My name is Liz Affelberg, and I have a question about potassium iodide. There was a one-time shot that where the public could get potassium iodide pills. This was many years ago, and I have not any recollection.
Miles of potassium iodide to all those states that request potassium iodide for their populations within the 10-mile emergency planning zone. We just recently sent out an offer making liquid potassium iodide in a pediatric formulation available also to requesting states. Once it is requested and received by the states or the counties, they develop their plans for distribution and stockpiling. I don't know the specifics, unfortunately, of the plans for your community here. Perhaps we have someone from the community response organization that can speak to that those plans. So you can request them from your county officials or your state officials to make those available to you.
I can speak to that a little bit. Again, Jim Grant from the County Office of Emergency Services. It is the iodine plan is a state plan that we have worked with the state extensively with. The state has accepted the iodide tablets. They are stockpiled here in the county. It would be up to the direction of the county health officer when those would be distributed, and that would be part of the decision-making process that we go through if there's ever an accident and we have our emergency operations center open and we have our command group, which the health officer is part of that. So the health officer then makes that decision. No, not necessarily. We don't know what that would be at the time nor when that would happen. So the plan is, but I will tell you that the plan is still being worked on. We've just received the information and the potassium iodide. So working with the plan, it is a state plan, but we're working with them to make sure that we are part of that process and make sure that we want a plan that works for us and our community as well. So. I believe that potassium iodine is actually available over the counter, but I'm not positive of that. You can check and see. But, again, it's up to our county health officer in terms of the distribution on that.
Just to add a note on potassium iodide, it is available over the counter, has been since 1978 for those that wanted to procure it. And it is effective up to 6 hours or so after exposure to radioactive iodine. In the United States, we're pretty fortunate because we have a pretty iodine-rich diet, so our thyroids typically run about 30% blocked anyway, unlike a lot of communities, for example, in former Soviet Union during the Chernobyl accident. They were iodine deficient, so that put them at a much greater risk from iodine inhalation than those of us here in this country.
Thank you. I'm Jerry Linthal, San Luis Obispo County Supervisor of the 3rd District, of which Diablo Canyon is part of the 3rd District. I want to thank you for being here, and I thank you before the last meeting we're here.
Thank you.
Have a two-part question. First, regarding evacuation, since that seems to be a key topic lately. During the recent hurricanes, Katrina and Rita, specifically what I'm referring to, what lessons have you, the NRC, learned regarding evacuation from or near nuclear power plants? And the second part of my question is, I would like you to elaborate on your experience or track record that the NRC has with spent fuel storage and go into a little more detail of the history there.
If we could, we'll take the second part first.
You want to take the first or second?
Yeah.
Yes. Are you interested in the track record as far as the safety or as far as our regulatory inspection findings?
Well, just for general information, if you could summarize how many plants have this facility online, how long they've been online, what's the history been, have there been any problems, have there been any lessons learned
about,
there?
There's about 37 sites online. There's one additional one coming online this week in our region. They have an exemplary safety record. There have been some minor issues that have been identified during cast loading operations, but none of these issues would have placed the integrity of the cask at risk or the structural components, but our threshold is low. There are over 700 individual casks that have been loaded in the country at various sites, and the cask and dry storage systems have been utilized in this country since, what, the mid-'80s? 86. So they have, you know, about 20 years of operating experience, and there's a number of different cask vendors and different types of cask systems, but fundamentally, they're basically the same. The differences relate to whether or not they're stored horizontally versus vertically, and some other features. But they have an outstanding safety record. It's a simple system. It's a passive system. Doesn't rely on electricity or any forced cooling, which makes it an inherently safe system.
Thank you. Now, if you could
just to add to that, my name is Randy Hall from the Spent Fuel Project Office at NRC headquarters.
Facilities to understand their preparations and response to severe winds and storm surge associated with hurricanes. And there are detailed procedures at all these facilities. They were implemented days ahead of time. And in fact, there is one facility that's approximately 20 miles west of New Orleans. The Waterford facility, and per its procedures, it shut down a day before the hurricane made landfall. In addition, the NRC, working through its incident response center, staffed up, and we went into 24-hour coverage, working very closely with FEMA, state and locals, to track the progress of the storm, to make sure that the preparations that needed to be in place for the plant were, in fact, in place. And I would just add parenthetically, nuclear power plants are specifically designed to withstand hurricane-force winds, and also the water facility, since it's right on the Mississippi River, is basically able to be locked down to withstand flooding. It has a number of watertight doors, et cetera. And so all these activities were occurring. We dispatched regional employees to the staff to the site. These are inspectors who were familiar with the site. They actually were locked down with the facility so that they could provide response and communications on the plant status during the storm. The storm did hit, as everybody knows, Louisiana. Essentially, the plant was unaffected. But I would say, the parish in which this plant is located is, like I said, it's about 20 miles west of downtown. It was essentially evacuated a couple of days before the storm hit. And so the locals in that particular parish experienced a few difficulties in population evacuation. Of course, they had plenty of notice. We did staff up. The facility was essentially undamaged. They did lose off-site power to the facility. But at this particular facility, and all facilities, they have backup emergency power systems. They worked as designed. And so after several days and after we, in conjunction with other federal agencies, worked very closely to assess on-site emergency preparedness capabilities and off-site emergency preparedness capabilities before the facility was restarted. And that occurred some 10 or 12 days after the storm made landfall. As in all storms, and we go through this, we also, within a few weeks, staffed up for Hurricane Rita, which is another Cat 5 storm, and that the initial track of that storm was making a beeline for a facility in South Texas before it changed course in the Gulf. After every one of these events, we do what we call a hot wash, detailed lessons learned, to make sure that we identify issues so that we do a better job next time. And I think some folks were probably aware that there were congressional hearings involving other federal agencies, and there were some failures and some tough lessons learned. We did participate in those hearings. And I don't mean to speak for Congress by any means, but I think if you were to look at the congressional record, you would see that the NRC, through its preparedness and in conjunction with state and local officials and with the facilities involved, which are owned and operated by the Entergy Corporation, were singled out for how to respond in such an event, how to do it right, to look for other federal agencies to look at some of those things. Now, having said that, there were lessons learned. And I think one of the principal lessons was communications. Communications, communications, communications. In response to Katrina, we dispatched inspectors with satellite telephones. We also coordinated closely with the site. They brought in 10 satellite lines. And so we never actually lost communications with the facility during the storm, even though, you know, like I said, it came within 20 miles of the facility. So that was one lessons learned. And there were others. And the agency has formed a task force to look at the lessons learned more rigorously so that we can apply those lessons to next year's storm season. And there's obviously I could talk on this subject for quite a while, and I'd be happy to share that with you with any detail that you'd like.
Good evening. My name is Judy Vick. Before Hurricane Katrina and Rita, the NRC ordered the nuclear plants shut down as a precaution, even those plants designed for a Category 5 hurricane. As we know, earthquakes and terrorists offer no advanced warning. During the 2003 wildfires in San Diego, 12 hours into the fires, deputies were still going door to door to alert people to the fire. Thousands never got official warning. Some were trapped for hours by fast-moving fires that blocked roads. During the 2003 earthquake in San Luis County, 60,000 residents were without power, and many cell phone towers did not operate. Many are concerned that our county still has an official door-to-door alert strategy in our cities and our back country. County and city leaders are still considering reverse 911 telephone alert systems. However, telephone lines would...
Power plants?
Yes.
Okay. Part of the initial licensing that goes into our reactors is emergency plans in place, and exercises, a full-scale exercise has to be conducted prior to the initial licensing of a power plant. All of the different aspects of emergency planning are looked at that time of initial licensing. After a plant is licensed, then we do regularly scheduled exercises on a periodic basis, approximately every 18 months to 2 years, to look at various aspects of emergency planning and its implementation. We don't require in our plans each time to demonstrate sheltering, for example. We have done some work recently with Sandia National Laboratories, where they've looked at all of the large-scale evacuations that have gone on in this country since 1990, and the definition of large-scale was more than 1,000 people from three or more buildings. They looked at very fast-moving events. They looked at malevolent acts, terrorist acts. They looked at natural disasters. There were over 300 evacuations that they studied in detail, including the California wildfires, because they are a good example of notifications, how to mobilize and move people. One of the important things that came out consistently across the country from all these different disasters was that the notification, the door-to-door notification, is one of the primary ways that the public is notified for non-nuclear disasters. It's been very effective in saving lives and in alerting people. Route alerting, where police go or emergency responders go around with a bullhorn to notify, has also been extremely effective. I can send you the study. It's a fairly exhaustive document. I didn't bring them with me because they're all very thick, and I'm happy to send them out to you for your review, and you can take a look at all of these things that have been done. But if you take a look at it, you look at other nations that have nuclear power plants. France, in particular, comes to mind. They don't require evacuation as a first line. They don't have extensive siren systems. They also do an alert and notification that's done on a door-to-door or through local first responders, bullhorn systems. Those are all different ways to notify, and they've all been demonstrated to be effective in notification of the public. And if you get with me on the break, I'll get your address, and I'll be happy to send you the reports.
Yes, my name is Rochelle Becker, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility.
Good evening.
I have a question, but I also have a comment on what you just said about the San Diego fires. There was an article in the San Diego paper yesterday, I believe it was, that said it took 11 days to finally notify everybody by their communication system, and that their reverse 9/11 didn't work, and going door-to-door took 11 days. So, you know, 11 days is a long time. So you might want to read some of those reports that have come out of that fire. My question is, in the past month, there has been bipartisan military and congressional efforts to keep both Skull Valley and Yucca Mountain from completion. In fact, today, Senator Reid announced that there will be a bipartisan piece of legislation put forth this week in Congress to have the nuclear waste left at reactor sites and not put in Yucca Mountain. There is also increasing support for keeping the high-level radioactive waste on site. We don't call it an ISPC here. It is a high-level radioactive waste storage facility. To our community, this means that the NRC's absence of a definition for the term temporary is unacceptable. An earthquake-prone nuclear site, such as Diablo Canyon, should not be left storing high-level radioactive waste in perpetuity. If there is no permanent high-level radioactive waste site safely operating by the end of current license terms, will the NRC deny applications for license renewal? And if not, why not?
My name is Randy Hall from the Spent Fuel Project Office. I think we all share concern about what the ultimate waste disposal in this country is going to be for spent nuclear fuel. I certainly agree that there's been a lot of reports in the news lately and uncertainty over the fate of Yucca Mountain and also the private fuel storage facility that you referred to. The NRC in licensing its dry cask storage facilities licenses those facilities for a set term of 20 years. The waste confidence decision that Blair Spitzberg mentioned in his opening remarks is the agency's statement that's consistent with the current national energy policy for the ultimate disposal of waste. If there is ultimately a change in that national policy, if there is some legislation that changes what is current.
Okay, hi. My name is Mickey. I had a question, a couple questions. Several months ago, I read in the Tribune, it was actually one of your people from PG&E stating that the containment domes could withstand a 500,000-pound jet traveling at 500 miles an hour with 170,000 pounds of fuel, a direct impact into the containment domes. I'm not sure if that is true, but could the storage casks also withstand such an impact at high speed from a jumbo jet? That would be my first question. The second question is, why is there not a Harrier jump jet, a high-speed helicopter, a Cobra helicopter, some aircraft out there to meet an aircraft halfway before something like this happens? In regards to what I heard here about the aircraft that dive-bombed the power plant, it sounds like it's a big concern since you guys are allowing airplanes to buzz the domes.
I'll answer the first part of your question regarding the vulnerability of a spent fuel storage cask to an aircraft crash. The NRC has, since 9/11, been conducting a number of detailed studies with the assistance of Sandia National Labs for a whole spectrum of terrorist scenarios based in part on the events of 9/11. One aspect of those studies involved the intentional crash of a large aircraft similar to the ones used in 9/11 into a spent fuel storage cask. Four different spent fuel storage cask designs were examined in the study, and it's been going on for a number of years. The conclusions from that study were that the likelihood is very low that radioactive releases from a spent fuel storage cask that was struck by a large aircraft would be significant enough to affect the nearby population. Those studies are currently being reviewed and evaluated by the Commission. Much of the information involved, the details, are sensitive security information that can't be released to the public. They also incorporate a number of different scenarios involving power plants and transportation. So the Commission's determination has been, up to this point, that spent fuel storage casks will be safe even in the event of an intentional aircraft crash. I'd also like to mention that along the lines of questions about security, there is a current proposed rule that the Commission is developing for revision to what's called the design basis threat. This is for the power plants. The comment period on that proposed rule extends until January the 23rd, and I can give you information on how to find out where to make contact comments and how to send them into the NRC. That rule is currently proposed does not address an aerial attack, but any members of the public who have concerns about that can certainly provide comments and recommendations in response to that rulemaking.
Regarding your other point, as I mentioned, we do coordinate closely with a number of other federal agencies, including the North American Air Defense Command, and without going into specific details, there is the capability to track and interdict aircraft. No, Ron. I think PG&E would like to make a comment.
Thank you. I'm Dave Oatley, Vice President General Manager at Diablo Canyon. And I didn't say anything when the first member of the audience mentioned the airplane approaching Diablo Canyon because it was characterized they could either confirm nor deny the accuracy of that. But it's sounding like it may be a statement of fact now, and I can tell you that there is a protocol that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just talked about regarding notification of unusual aircraft activity. We have deployed that communication. We have had interdiction by the FBI, interrogated pilots, and those of us here in the room tonight are not aware of any unusual aircraft activity in May of this year. So all I can say is we're not aware of anything, and we have in the past used the process they mentioned and interdicted pilots. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh. Hi, my name is Carol Anderson. And I'd just like to make the panel as well as the public aware of an interesting experience that I had. In spring of 2004, I'm sure some of you remember, I recognize some faces, Bill Jones and others, you had a series of meetings to the community. One of them, of course, was here. Another was at the Cliffs Restaurant. And I attended that one, and I remember seeing, and I donned, first of all, we went through a guarded area with men with machine guns wearing camo and all that. And there were a few people coming out. But when we got upstairs to the offices in PG&E, you know, the office area with partitions similar to those in the back, only smaller, the lights were out and there was nobody there. Okay, that was kind of strange. And Jeff went into a room and got a plastic helmet for me, and I put that on, and then goggles. I put those on. And then we walked into a steel door area. He held the door open for me, and there was the sound of the steam generators running. That was sort of an ear-piercing sound, and he gave me earplugs. I put those on, and we walked further into the room, and it was freshly painted. It smelled of fresh paint, and it was beautiful, nicely shiny, you know, gloss paint in nice colors, white and clean and spiffy looking. And then we walked further over, and I remember it was the north reactor and steam generating room area, so I don't know what reactor or what steam generator it was, but I looked through to a glass room and could see people in there, so I was thinking, okay, there are people up here besides us. And this is the weird part. As we got closer toward the middle of that big area, just huge, huge area, I heard a hissing sound, and I looked over to the left. This is a true story. Looked over to my left, and there was this center steam generator turbine thing, and there was a hissing sound coming from one of the pipes, and it said, like you'd see a floor thing saying, caution, wet floor. It said, caution, steam leak, danger, stand back, stand clear. And I have a little black spot in my eye that I got about 2 months after that trip. It was probably like around September or October. And I still have it. And I still think it's strange. And I know at the meetings that they had at the Cliffs, they talked about some leaks, but I didn't expect to encounter one hissing right there in front of me. So I think that decommissioning should be in order. We live in an earthquake-prone zone, a tsunami-prone zone. Santa Barbara has, just south of Santa Barbara, landslide. So aside from terrorism, there are natural disasters that are God-made and man can't control, like this steam leak. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for those comments. As I indicated, my name is Bill Jones. I'm the branch chief with responsibility for Diablo Canyon. I have two resident inspectors there full-time. Sounds like you got the tour that you actually went on was first into the administrative building, which is essentially the office building for the engineering staff and other staff, which is essentially separate from the power block itself. And listening to your description, you went down a hallway, an overpass area, you're able to look out over the ocean into a large area, and you talked about two steam generators. Those are actually the main generators, in other words, the electrical production side of the house that's essentially common to all power plants. And in listening, because I took a tour there yesterday, it sounds like the area that you were listening to would have been a steam leak associated with the steam going to one of the either a high pressure turbine or low pressure turbine, or that actually causes the generator to turn. That building is actually the turbine building. It is separate from the containment. The containment is actually what houses the reactor and the steam generators. And this is the secondary side of the plant. So I just wanted to add that from your descriptions, it sounds like you were talking about the secondary side of the plant, which is the clean steam. Some of the leaks that have been discussed before were we look at the primary to secondary leaks and associated with the steam generators, but that sounds like where you were was completely separate. Yep. With the plant of power operations, it's quite an evolution to go inside the containment itself.
Right. I would just add that again, my name's Art Howell. Since we weren't actually there, and based on your description, it's difficult for us to say exactly where you were since we weren't on the tour with you. But I will say that it's not uncommon for plants to have minor steam leaks, and they get tracked and they get repaired. And in many cases, depending on what they are, they have little or no operational impact, much less safety impact on the site. But since we don't know the specifics, it's hard for us to comment directly.
I was under the impression that just to my right inside that glass room were people that were controlling the reactor, that the reactor I was looking at was right there. But I wanted to just follow up, and I forgot to tell you this, and Jeff Lewis will confirm this too. And I'm not sure if you've been inside. Have you had a tour of the plant?
Yes.
Okay, there's a separate area where you enter, and then there's an exit area, because I kept asking Jeff after that, do we go through a Geiger counter? You know, I'm just a little concerned about that steam leak. You know, just want to be checked out. Oh, yeah, and he started muttering the words as we were leaving, because there were no guards in this area that you walk out of. There were these units, I don't know, like the size of a portable refrigerator that you take to college, a couple of those. And we were supposed to walk through those with guards there, with them turned on. And Jeff said, oh, yeah, you get the reading. You'll get to see. You know, it'll be nothing. You know, or if you ate a banana, it might have a little potassium in it, and it'll show up. But he said, we'll definitely get to do that. Don't worry.
The steam in a plant of a design like Diablo is clean. There's essentially no radioactivity in the steam. So there's no danger from it from a radioactivity point of view. The caution sign around the steam leak is because the steam is very hot, and you don't want people inadvertently walk up to some hot steam. This is not a large leak in that context, but we do want to put safety first at the plant. I don't know about the monitor on the exit. We don't typically have guards there because the guards are through a bulletproof glass window and can see. You go through, when you exit the plant, you go through a turnstile, and there is a radiation monitor. You pause in for 2 seconds and then leave. That detects any radioactivity that's on your person before you leave the site. I was not aware that was not operational. We'll look into that when we get back to the plant. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for your patience and your time. We're going to have two more speakers right now, and then we're going to take a short break, just a couple minutes worth, And then I know several of you have already given me an indication you wish to speak, so I will get to you, okay?
Hey, Ron, would you include in your before our break, Mr. Deenan? He indicated a desire to speak, and he was here very early, too.
My name is Joan Carter, and my question is, under what circumstances is sheltering preferable to evacuation? What is the safest route there, given that we have so few roads out of here with incredible traffic congestion that would occur? That's the bottom line question that most people seem to have. Do I stay or go? But I also wanted to just comment that our local newspaper, the Tribune in the county, is doing a series of investigative series this week, published this week, on our disaster preparedness in this county, which includes the Diablo Canyon possible leak. And they've already pre-warned us that it is really poor, that it is sorely lacking. So I think that's going to be published tomorrow. So when you answer my question, I intend to compare it to what the Tribune has to say also.
Okay. Under what conditions is sheltering appropriate? There are many different...
Comparing it to evacuation.
There are many times when there may be a short-term release, and it may make sense to shelter as opposed to put people into traffic and put them in the pathway of a plume. Severe weather conditions, and we see that frequently up in the Northeast with severe ice storms and snowstorms and such, is another time when sheltering may be the preferred option. There are considerations now, and we've put out a bulletin not that long ago, NRC has, looking at sheltering in the event of a terrorist attack. It may make sense to keep people in a sheltered posture as opposed to putting them on the roads while there may be a terrorist attack ongoing. You don't necessarily want to move people into harm's way. Your local decision makers, the utility licensee works with the local decision makers, what's happening at the plant, what's the projections, what's the expectations, and then those people who intimately know the community, and that's your emergency response and your emergency management officials, make the decision what will be best for the citizens of this community. In some instances, it may be to shelter this particular part of the population and to move this particular segment of the population. Those are decisions that are made dependent upon the event and in coordination with many factors that are ongoing, weather, for example, of terrorist attack, those kinds of things. So those are all the factors that are considered. Those are things we look at for sheltering. There's no absolute sheltering always here, evacuation always here. Many factors go into it that are looked at that time. And as far as the adequacy or inadequacy of your emergency planning and your dedication resources and all, I think we have some folks here from the county who may be willing to speak to that, because we can't, obviously.
Hi, Jim Grant again. Yes, that's a good question. And I think that was a good answer that was given right there. It really just depends on what type of accident has occurred, what are the weather conditions, what are the road conditions, is it a short-term release? Again, what happens is that we get our emergency operations center up and running. We have the health officer, we have the CHP, we have Caltrans, we have the state. We have a whole variety of our experts there to take a look at what's going on and then to make an informed decision. I will tell you that in all the years that I've been involved in this, though, the evacuation is a preferable protective action if that is possible. So at all times it's preferable. We're going to probably recommend to the public to evacuate. But there could be a short release that it wouldn't make sense to do that, to be in your car. So there's 100 different there the whole time, and they wrote a report on that of how well we did, how impressed they were with the emergency organization. So, again, if you look at the paper, there are always areas that we need to work on, and I would never disagree with that. We're always looking to do better, but by and large, if you compare our county organization, the city organizations, with other counties and cities, we are head and shoulders above them because we have practiced and we've had practiced and drilled and planned for years and years and years for not only Diablo Canyon, but for earthquakes, for tsunamis, for the variety of natural occurring events that we have here. So we have a very experienced crew, and I think we do relatively good job. Again, we're always looking to do better. We're not perfect. We never will be, but we strive to be excellent at what we do.
Thank you. We have two more we're going to get to before our break.
Hi, my name is David Nelson. I have a statement and a couple of questions. I'm kind of cynical here myself because, you know, I've been up here since 79 when Diablo was just coming online. I've heard all the promises. I was here when we found out that they, you know, used the wrong blueprints and built it backwards. No problem. You know, I was here when we were told that there would be none of this. There would be no storage of high radiation fuel on this site. Now, here we are here. I hear from up the panel that about Yucca Mountain. Anybody who believes that Yucca Mountain is going to open, I'm sorry, I have a little cynicism about that also. I mean, the reality of the situation is they've taken the money, they've wasted it, and it's gone. One of my questions is, how long do we put up with this insanity? How much is this going to cost? You know, I heard our million solar panel housing in California was going to cost $1.5 billion. That was going to give us over 2,000 megawatts of energy. That's what Diablo Canyon puts out. Why aren't we spending this money on something real, like solar energy, like, you know, geothermal, things that don't create this stuff? We're talking about a 20-year cast here for stuff that lasts forever. I mean, how can we, the public, trust this? I mean, we're asking the NRC, you people make your money off of this, to stop doing this. I've been doing this for years, asking agencies to stop doing it. They don't want to do it, stop doing it, because they make their living off of this. I believe that all you people believe what you're saying, but the reality of the situation is none of us are going to be around as long as this fuel is going to be around. And, you know, to ask us to keep trusting, it's just foolish. It's just foolish. Another question I have is at a workshop sponsored by CEC this past August, repackaging of high-level radioactive waste was discussed. Can you explain this process to us? And again, you know, it's just we're sitting here, you know, 20-some years after this started with no real answers. All we do is keep throwing money at these problems, keep employing people who keep telling me how good these processes are. These processes aren't good. Yucca Mountain's not going to open. Even if it does open, so many states aren't going to allow us to pick up these 300,000-ton or pound cast and move them across state lines. Come on, how long are we going to keep this insanity up? There's better ways to create energy. I keep hearing all this. One of my pet peeves about Diablo, that back when they did their thermo studies, they estimated the loss of X amount of habitat in the ocean from this. All of a sudden, we're found out with new studies that it's almost double what they told us then. The water control, water quality control board has a cease and desist order on the table for Diablo Canyon because of this. I know everybody likes to shake their heads and yo-ho because they have more scientists than people that are trying to stop this kind of energy, but how long does it continue? How much does it cost? I mean, how do you justify this? How do you people sleep at night? Thank you.
I'm not sure where to start, Mr. Johnson. You had a number of questions there, and I may need to ask you to go back and restate some of them. But let me start by saying I share your frustration over the lack of this country's delay in developing a permanent disposal option for high-level waste. Having said that, I do not share your concern over whether this nation will develop a permanent option for disposal. The issues that we know we need to focus on when that application does come in, and we have defined those issues and worked with the Department of Energy to characterize and study the issues so that when the license application does come in, we will be able to complete our review within the 3 to 4 years that we're required, mandated by law, to license the repository.
Or to review the application and make a determination.
To make a determination whether it can be licensed. That's correct. As far as shipment of radioactive waste, there are shipments of spent nuclear fuel that take place in this country. It's not a frequent operation, but there are shipments that have been made and are made, and it is done safely. There have been no accidents involving the shipment of radioactive waste involving spent nuclear fuel that resulted in release of radioactive material. I wasn't sure I understood your question concerning the waste process that you wanted us to try and explain. Maybe if you could restate that question.
He needs the mic.
Yeah, at a workshop sponsored by CEC this past August, repackaging of high-level radioactive waste was discussed. Can you explain the process?
I'm not sure I understand the context of the question. The packaging of the high-level waste that occurs at the power plant is what we discussed this evening,
right?
Because once they put that fuel in those canisters, it is in effect in the transport package that will be used to transport that. Now, there are some additional impact limiters that will be added prior to transport, but that is the package that fuel is intended to be transported in.
Now, you said that lasts for 20 years after the licensing of the plant, or these casks last 20 years. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the cask can last longer than 20 years. They are licensed for a 20-year period. Randy, do you want to address the license period?
Yes, our regulations currently allow for up to a 20-year license for dry cask storage. It is subject to renewal, and there have been two facilities that have requested renewal of their dry cask storage licenses. The NRC has reviewed those and determined that the casks that have been in use for 20 years can still be safely used for an additional 20 years beyond that.
Regarding your other point, sir, the choice as to what type of electrical production is carried out by a particular company is their choice. It's not an NRC choice, and our job is to obviously review an application if it's for a new power plant and make a determination about whether it should get a license, and then if it does get one, to make sure that it's constructed and operated in accordance with our regulations. In terms of monies that are received, folks may not know this, but the NRC is, it's not quite 100%, but it's almost 100% fee recovery agency, which means that all the licensees we regulate, we actually charge them fees, and they pay those fees, and then they go into the general fund of the U.S. Treasury, and then the Congress appropriates our budget. So that's how the system is set up.
My name is Bill Dineen, and I'm told to keep it short. I've left what I'm going to say on the table right in the corner right there.
If you want to read it,
I won't be able to cover the whole thing because I'm told to make it short. But I urge the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at this season of the year of giving, give us a gift. Close Diablo. Now, I've been around for a long time, and I don't know how much longer I'll be here. I've visited Diablo Canyon before there was any nuclear power plant even thought of being put there. Beautiful canyon would have made a wonderful national park. Okay, also back in, I was a long time ago a college professor, and my specialty was biology. A geologist by the name of Ralph Varana said, he taught at Cal Poly, and he lost his job. I think as a result of this. He said there was a earthquake fault near Diablo. Ooh. And subsequently, the PG&E found it there. Wow. I said nuclear waste is dangerous for too long, and we shouldn't be making it until we know what to do with it. Okay, things move along, 1978, and I was arrested. Everyone did that. We would not need Diablo. Okay? So this is some of the background that is so important for our, and I love your concerns and suggestions there of closing down the plant. We do not need Diablo. And the reason I say that is, well, there are quite a few of them raise your hands that you dry your laundry, but only one person raised their hand that they have photovoltaics. Why doesn't every single house, when it's built, have put into that photovoltaics? It makes electricity, and we wouldn't need Diablo if we had everybody had them on their roof. I want to compliment our so long. She has been active on the protection of us for so long. And I remember back in, I guess it was 67, when this young lady came to my class in biology and said, you know, this plant doesn't belong there. And she's been active, and I don't know how much time she's put in, but her life has been devoted for the protection of us. And I say, on Christmas time, and I am dressed appropriately to say so, get a gift from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and close this plant now. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Ron, I believe Diablo Canyon would like to respond.
I know I stand between us and a break, so excuse me for a minute. I'd like to bring some more information into the room, if I might, after the last couple of speakers. PG&E, as a company, is implementing the loading order from the California Public Utilities Commission, and the first priority from the state of California is conservation. And so we encourage conservation. We're in the process of spending $1 billion to put automatic meter readers at all the residential homes in a way to encourage conservation. The next order in which we dispatch is in renewables, and we have a requirement to meet 20% of our total generation from renewable sources. We're currently at 13%. We'll meet the 20% by the year 2010. And then we get into the other sources of generation, such as fossil, hydroelectric, and Diablo. Now, for some members in the room, Diablo does produce 20% of the energy for our customers of PG&E and 10% of the energy for the entire state. And the only source of energy less expensive than Diablo Canyon is hydroelectric power. So it's a very inexpensive source of electricity, but it does come in that order from PG&E of conservation first, renewable second, and then the conventional plants. Thank you.
Okay. How is it the cheapest?
I guess I'm answering that.
Well, at this point, I would suggest that if folks could hold their questions and we'll just do a process check. We're about 2 hours into the meeting and really good discussion so far. I appreciate it. We would like to take a short break. And then, Ron, how much? 10 minutes?
We were looking at 5 minutes.
5 minutes. 5 minute break. 5 minute. And we'll come back to you, sir. Oh, we're having a break.